Kadosh. Remember, remember, Adonai Eloheinu.
Welcome to Romamu, an open-hearted Jewish community and house of worship, learning, and spiritual growth. You're listening to Romamu's podcast, where we share words of Torah, insights, and inspiration from Romamu clergy. Thank you for being with us.
This is not a complaint at any level. I'm not crushing. I don't want sympathy. Just telling you, I'm sure all of you can appreciate this. I hope many of you can appreciate this. I think I'm not the only rabbi who's tired of getting up and talking about what's going on in Israel. It's just an invitation to the end of Shabbat Shalom, invitation to end the peace of Shabbat where we can all sing together and harmonize together without knowing what our political views are, what we posted on Twitter, whatever it's called now, and the book of the face and the other things and the grams and this, which is just an invitation to more wasting of your life, in my personal opinion. Going down rabbit holes and doom scrolling and all of that is just another way of saying, I want to be in a community. I just want to talk to people, fight with them. It's even better than being alone here in my house watching something, which is not to say, of course, that it doesn't have to be done. It's not to say, of course, that it doesn't have, unfortunately, inevitably, this moment in time, inexorably, ineluctably, we can't get out of it. There's no way. But in Shul, Halavai just wanted us to sing together. I've been saying that for 3 months. So I'm going to say some things tonight that are on my heart and mind. And I hope, and I keep every Friday night, I hope that what I'm saying comes from a place that you know that I'm struggling also with you. And no rabbi, I don't care if they're Rabbi Sharon Brous, or if it's Elliot Kostrov, or an Orthodox rabbi, or this rabbi, or professor, we don't know. We have strong opinions sometimes, but like everybody else, we're partial, we're biased, we come from our perspectives, we have our backgrounds, and I don't know any of your backgrounds either, so forgive me if I say something that hurts you in any way, God forbid, if not my intention. I hope I won't. But, you know, I'm not just saying that so that I can go ahead and do it now. I really don't want to. I really don't. I promise you. And let me also say that as a congregant in any synagogue, it's even absurd for me to say this, but of course you can disagree with the rabbis of the synagogue. Doesn't mean that you're going to be giving the next week's sermon. It also doesn't mean that you have to leave, because again, like any human being, rabbis express their opinion. They do their best to try to find what something is true and for them and come from the heart. And hopefully we can still love each other even if we disagree with each other. There's no more beautiful and satisfying screenplay in all of Western literature than the final 13 chapters of the book of Genesis. Those chapters tell a story of Joseph and his brothers, and for all intents and purposes, the entire 13 chapters of the Joseph narrative are the answer to the question asked by Cain, in the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis, HaShomer Achi Anochi, am I my brother's guardian? And the power of the Joseph narrative is that it lies exactly on that place. It seeks to answer that question, but does it in economical language and brilliant screenwriting that brings the generational issue of chosenness, favoritism, and rejection to an entirely new register than any previous story in the Bible had done. And it reaches its denouement, reaches its height this coming Shabbos. As the machinations of a capricious-seeming ruler whose identity is revealed only to the readers but not to the brothers who stand before this ruler comes to its apotheosis, comes to its full expression. Joseph has completely manipulated his brothers from the moment that he recognized them, and they did not recognize him, of course. He recognized them, but they did not recognize him. He recognized that his dream had come true and that he had the power in his hands to do to them what they had done to him. He knew his dream was true. The Torah tells us as soon as he saw them, and Joseph remembered his dreams. And the dreams came true. The dreams didn't say anything about making them suffer. The dreams didn't say anything about playing a game with them. The dream just said, well, 11 stars, 11 right sheaves are going to bow down. And it happened. And he said, okay, I'm done. And then we as the readers know that he's not done. He's going to come at them with false accusations and with framing. He's going to make all kinds of libelous statements that the brothers will know are not true. You came here as spies. What do you mean, spies? We're just brothers. Our father's at home. No, you're spies. And then he works on them. I won't trust you, right, until you come and bring your brother down here. And they're on the way, and he puts the money back in the sack, and then one of their brothers, Shimon, has to be left as a collateral. They go back to Jacob, and Jacob's sitting there going, no way, I'm not going through this again. I'm not going to give my second beloved son, right, the one that I really, really love, from the wife that I really, really love. But of course, Judah's impassioned plea, the fourth son of Leah, Judah's impassioned plea brings Jacob to the recognition that he has to let go of Benjamin. And Benjamin comes down, and then at the end of last week's Torah portion, right, the knife is being turned because Benjamin, the beloved, the one who is the last remaining of Rachel's two children, right, another framing, he apparently has stolen the most powerful man in the world's goblet of divination, and the brothers tear their garments in recognition that something karmic, something profoundly wrong has taken place. And this screenplay leaves us with a cliffhanger at the end of last week's Torah portion. The brothers are bereft, and Judah, right, they said to them, whoever has the goblet should die, and we will become slaves. And they're on their way back for this meeting with their own past, with their own history. And it's at that moment that the parsha opens. Vayigash elav Yehuda, and Judah steps forward. And Judah approaches power, approaches terror, approaches a present moment that he can't control, with the specter of his father's death hanging above him, knowing that he had said in last week's Torah portion, I will be collateral for the child, Anochi Arvenu, Miyadi Tivakshenu, Imlo Aviecha. If I don't bring him back to you, Judah says, then right, I will be personally collateralized for his safety. And he steps forward. And what is public to us is that he begins the longest speech in the book of Genesis that is full of nuance. He begins by setting the record straight. Let me tell you what took place. And he goes over the list of things that, you know, what brought us to this moment, as if others weren't there, but he wants to take control of the narrative, and he wants to begin telling people what took place. And then he entreats the viceroy, Joseph. He entreats him to allow him to be placed instead of Benjamin, and to free Benjamin, because after all, if you don't let him go and we come back to our father, your servant, the word our fathers appears 14 times in his remarks. If we come back to our father, your servant, without the child, he will die. What is public to us as readers is the Judah who is appeasing, the Judah who is the statesman, the diplomat, Judah who knows how to persuade. He clearly will succeed. But what's not known to us is a completely different conversation that the rabbis in the Midrash paint a story around. They don't see a monologue from Judah, but in the interstices and in the white spaces around Judah's remarks, they see a dialogue, a very intense dialogue. And the dialogue goes like this in the Midrash. It's not anywhere in the Torah. The rabbis make it up and they expand it. In multiple Midrashim, in Bereshit Rabbah, in Tanhuma. Here is the Tanhuma, early Midrashic source. Judah approached Joseph and said to him, Tedalecha shemitchila lo bata leinu ele balilot. He comes to Joseph and says, you came to us with all kinds of false accusations, libels. B'tchila amarnu lanu miraglimatem. You said to us, we're spies. And then you said to us, you came to see the nakedness of the land. And then you said to us that the goblet you stole, tanishbate b'chaye paro harasha, you swore to us, right? You swore to us by Pharaoh's life that you would, right? That you would take care of them. Amar lo Yosef, im totzeh charbecha min artiko ani korchol tzavarecha. And then, so then Judah said, I'm going to take out my big sword. And Joseph said, you take out your big sword, and I'm going to break it on your neck. Amar lo Yehuda, if I open up my mouth, I'm going to swallow you whole. And Joseph said back, if you open up your mouth, I will close it with a rock. Judah said to Joseph, what are we going to say to Dad? And Joseph said, Kvar margi lecha, emor l'avicha, alach achev lecha radli. He said, go tell Dad that the rope went in after the bucket. Judah says to him, din sheker ata dan otanu. Judah says, you are creating a kangaroo court. And Joseph says, sheker, a lie? You're going to tell me about lying? Is there any greater lie than selling your own brother into slavery? It goes on. In another rendering of this conversation, the rabbis imagine that Judah, for every moment that Judah says, we are innocent, Joseph says, oh yeah? What about what happened here? And Judah's like, oh, okay. But we're innocent in this moment. And then Joseph says, and what about with Bilhah, when he stole? And so they go back and forth. One protests their innocence and the other protests that they are the oppressor. One says, we're the victim. And the other says, no, we're the victim. And they're fighting back and forth. Isn't it beautiful the way Torah mirrors reality? No, we're the victim. No, we're the victim. Well, if you look at the past here and if you look at the past there, where do you begin history? Is it 47, 48? Is it 67, 73? Judah and Joseph going back and forth. And what's at stake, for the rabbis is really, can Judah understand what Joseph needs to hear for this to be over? What does Joseph need to hear for this to be over? Here Judah thinks that they came down and this is completely, they're innocent. They're completely innocent. And he comes to Joseph and says, this is completely trumped up. This is completely made up. And in the rabbi's narrative, it's not. Joseph says, what do you mean? Everything you did until this moment is the reason why this is happening. Not for karma's sake, but because I need to know something. I need to know something here from you. I need to know that you've changed. I need to know that before I lay down my arms, before I retract from this vast machination that was created in order for me to test you to see if you're different. Will it be different? I refuse to become the brother you imagine me to be, Joseph says, until you acknowledge that I have spent 20 years terrified of going home because I don't know if going home is safe. 11 brothers, 10 brothers, who knows? Maybe you're still the same man you were before. Maybe your promises are empty. Maybe your regret, your remorse is empty. Maybe you're just talking, but I need security. I need safety. I need to know that I won't participate in this reconciliation until I can trust that it won't happen again. And what's remarkable, really, in what the rabbis do here is, at least according to Nechama Leibowitz, in imagining a dialogue between Judah and Joseph that is not in the Torah itself, the rabbis do a remarkable thing. They really place that dialogue as an internal conversation between Judah and himself. Judah himself, at least according to Nechama Leibowitz, is actually fighting internally, saying all of these arguments back and forth in his own mind. That really resonated for me. I don't know about you, but so much of what's playing out in the public space now, in the public sphere, is an externalization of what's happening for so many of us internally. Our own insecurities, our own assurances, assurities, things that we think for sure, and then there are things that we're not so clear on. And it's a very complicated device, the public space. It's a very complicated space. It's without a doubt the case that the rabbis here, in imagining this dialogue between the brothers or internally to Judah, as Nechama Leibowitz said, are recognizing that maybe it wouldn't have been so great to publish this dialogue so that everybody could read it. Not everything, right, when it comes to transparency, needs to be out in the public space. It really spoke to me at this moment about the intimacy of that conversation, the trust involved, the back and forth, the levels of energy internal to Judah, maybe between him and Joseph, whatever it is. I don't know if there are any safe spaces to have those kinds of conversations anymore about where things should start and where we should start the story and whose fault is it, you know, and all those questions. So for a moment, I want to imagine that none of that conversation actually mattered until Judah said, put me in place of Benjamin. Until Joseph saw Judah step forward and say, whether I know it or not, I'm going to do it differently this time. And that shifted everything. So I want to read to you something that shifted me this week, two things that shifted me this week. And with that, I'll leave you as confused as I am and finish up the night. In a completely different register, the Midrash imagines another conversation that broke Joseph's heart. It wasn't a conversation about who was right and who was wrong. It was a conversation about whether the brothers had changed. It was a conversation about how missed Joseph was. In the Midrash, and last week's Torah portion brought in this week's also the Midrash, when they brought Joseph back from, in order to get food, Benjamin back to bring food. They brought Benjamin before his brother, and he stood there in front of his brother, Joseph. And Joseph asked out loud, is this your youngest brother to whom you have referred? And they said, yes. And then Joseph said privately, it feels that way in the text, intimately to Benjamin, his younger brother, whom he hasn't seen in over 20 years. He said to him, do you have children? He said, no, I'm sorry. He said, are you married? He said, yes. Do you have children? Sounds almost like, you know, going to a... Anyway, not going to say it. Anyway, okay. Do you have children? He said, yes, I have 10 children. And then Joseph asked his younger brother Benjamin, what's their names? People know this Midrash? Beautiful. He goes on, he starts to say the names, Bela, Becher, Ashbel. And Joseph says, whoever heard of names like that? You never heard any? He's like, what kind of names are those? Benjamin says, I've called all of them by these names because of my brother, the son of my mother. Bela, because he was swallowed up, Bala. Becher, because he was the firstborn, a Bechor. Ashbel, because he was taken captive, Shvi. Gera, because he became a stranger in a strange land. It goes on. Naaman, because he was gentle, the word Naim. Echi, because he was my brother, Achi. Rosh, because he was my superior, Roshi. And Mupim, because he was beautiful, from the word Yafeh. And lastly, I named my last child Chupa, Hupim, because he did not see my Chupa, and I did not see his. It's unbelievable, Midrash. So moving, right? It's reconciliation between these two brothers. If it's true that Judah and Joseph exchanged angry words, each one accusing one another of blame, it's true, as Nechama Leibowitz points out, that the conversation internal to Judah reflects our own conversations, but I don't believe it will be the rancor of Twitter, the arguments on CNN or on YouTube that will move the needle, but conversations about lost opportunities, lost futures, stolen past and present that will bring us to a new place. The names of our children will be named after the lost brothers and sisters and children of both Israel and Gaza. And we will be moved together as a common humanity towards a future based on the brokenheartedness that we feel when we recognize that loss, the gravity of all that might have been but wasn't. What is so remarkable about Joseph is about hearing about all of the 10 brothers of his 10 nephews. He cries for the first time in the Torah. Tears well up, and his own softening begins. He begins to realize that life did not just go on without him, but that he had left an indelible residue on all of those who had been there that finally when Judah acknowledges and changes his past, brotherly affection began again. I like to imagine that. I'm going to end with this story because it touched me and I think it's connected, but it might not be. I'm sure many of you know about what took place with the three abducted hostages who freed and were accidentally killed by Israel last week. And in all of the questions, some legitimate, some not, about what that says about the Israeli army, most of them not legitimate questions. Of course, what was lost in all of that was the absolute horror, what it was for a brother to accidentally kill another brother in Israel. The absolutely unimaginable life ahead for those who know that they made a horrible, tragic, tragic mistake. And in a moment that absolutely mirrors the end of this week's Torah portion, where Joseph, after acknowledging and allowing himself to love his brothers again, also heals them by saying to them, it's not your fault. There was a reason why this happened and I'm here. The mother of Yotam Chaim, Iris Chaim, whose son was 28 when he was abducted, of course, from Kibbutz Kfar Aza on 10/7, wrote a letter to those soldiers. I'm sure many of you saw it. I wanted to tell you, she said to them, that I love you very much. And I hug you here from afar. I know that everything that happened is absolutely not your fault and nobody's fault except that of Hamas. And may their name be wiped out and their memory erased. I want you to look after yourselves and to think all the time that you are doing the best thing in the world. The best thing that could happen. That could help us, because all of Israel and all of us need you to be healthy. Don't hesitate for a second in your duties. Don't think that you killed a hostage deliberately, God forbid. You have to look after yourselves, because only that way can you look after us. And at first opportunity, she said, you are invited to come to us, whoever wants to come. We want to see you with our own eyes and hug you and tell you what you did. However hard it is to say this and sad, that what you did was apparently the right thing at that moment. And nobody's going to judge you or be angry. Not me, not my husband, Raviv, not my daughter, Noya, and not Yotam, and may his memory be a blessing. And not Tuval, Yotam's younger brother. We love you very much. And that is all, she wrote. This moment, so different in kind, quality of forgiveness and open-heartedness from someone who has every reason to be angry, every reason to be enraged, every reason to point fingers, every reason, but her heart opens wide to forgive and to make sure that those who will be carrying this for the rest of their lives carry it lighter because of her. I'm praying deep in my heart that those who leave because I mentioned something about soldiers, possibly, or those who are watching who might be thinking that this is some kind of call for ceasefire or some such thing, I want to go back to the way that I used to speak about this, which is praying that innocent lives are not lost. No more innocent lives. No more innocent lives. We're praying that we find a way to make sure that Joseph feels safe again, that Joseph will see change that allows our people to come back to the areas near Gaza, knowing that they have legitimate reasons to be scared, knowing that there are legitimate reasons to not countenance terror organizations who live on your doorstep, and also back to being able to hear from brothers and cousins again about all of the lost opportunities that all of us participated in creating, all of the lost chances over the years and all of the chuppahs that we're not going to go to and others won't go to. Then maybe this remarkable mother's example of forgiveness, may the remarkable example of others who are trying in unimaginably difficult moments like this to find a way to remember humanity wherever we can find it, be something for us at this moment. That's all I got. That's what I got. That's it. May God bless us, really. Bless us, those who are defending us, that they be safe. Pray as if this is something else. It is not at all and should never be difficult to imagine Palestinian dignity and sovereignty, advocating for the fullest expression of Palestinian national aspirations to be realized at some point alongside Israel, with safety and security, brothers and sisters and cousins being able to live together, should not at all in any way, shape, or form be a contradiction to being able to say, like Joseph did, I want to see that you've changed. I want to see that we can live together. I'm praying for that day deeply. May Hashem watch over all of the innocent, especially our brave chayalim, the chayalot.
Thank you for listening. Want more content like this? Subscribe to our podcast and visit romamu.org to learn more about us. Please consider making a contribution to Romamu so we can continue to fulfill our mission to help spiritual seekers deepen their connection to Jewish wisdom and practice to help them become more compassionate human beings. We hope to see you in the synagogue or the Zoomagogue soon. Romamu, Romamu, Adonai.